This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I have the pleasure of talking to David George Haskell. He's the author of an absolutely incredible, wonderful book called The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature. How are you, David?
I'm well. Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, it's really nice to meet you over the phone. I've just enjoyed this book tremendously. It's just as introduction to people who are listening, what you set out to do, which I think is just it's a great idea, and that is to study a 1 meter square piece of old growth forest in Tennessee near where you live and teach, and you started on. The book formally starts on the 1st of January of a year and ends on December 31st. I noticed on the jacket they mentioned that you went out weekly, but inside the book you said something about actually going out frequent more than once a week, which was sort of the impression that I got. How often did you go into the woods during the course of this year?
I did not have a set schedule, but I tried to go out many times a week. Sometimes I'd go more than once a day, particularly if there were not a lot of other things pressing on my time. And so I went to the forest many more times than there are chapters in the book, right? So one of the challenges was picking out which events am I going to write about, and which make a sort of coherent narrative for the book.
Right. Now, did you keep a diary?
I spent hundreds of hours out there during that 1 year.
Did you keep a diary as every day you went and then chose things to write about from that, or did you just remember and then say, well, today's a day I saw something really interesting and I want to use that as the jumping off point for a piece of writing?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what I did in the woods was I restricted myself to having a hand lens, a pair of binoculars, and a notebook. And in the notebook, I would write, just do little sketches of the plants and animals, and just write down some of the events as they happened. But I didn't write any of these chapters out there. The book was more of the notebook in the field was more of a kind of messy, just thing for describing things so that I could later remember them a little better. And then after I came back, I would go to the library and read up about the things that I'd seen out in the forest. So, I might see an ant trying to pull a little seed of a wildflower across the forest floor, and I knew roughly what that ant was up to and what the ecological context was. But I didn't know exactly what people had been writing about this in the scientific literature over the last few years. And so I'd dig up papers from journals and read about those. Then I would sit down and write a chapter about that might have ants and wildflowers as one of the things that's happening.
Right. One of the things that I thought was incredible about this book, and I've been, reading some of it out loud to my wife and telling my daughter, who's a biology student, about it. And just, what's been remarkable for me was that you took from these very, very small observances, a mm-hmm. thing that was going on. It might be at the level of, as you said, an ant, or it could be fungus or tick, mm-hmm. Mycorrhizal fungus, sure. That launched into, in a sense, a meditation, but also this kind of biological and naturalist evocation, as you just described it. I didn't realize as I was reading this that you had done it the way you just described to me. So I've been thinking that you were just the most knowledgeable naturalist that ever lived, because I loved learning as so much. I mean, that was the thing that really struck me, is that this is a relatively short book. It's about 250 pages long. There's just so much information, and it's also beautifully written, so that this is not like a textbook where you say, oh, here's an ant and here's what happens. You talk about this sort of the web of nature in a really evocative and beautiful way.
thank you,
You know,
thank you.
each being a kind of, as I said, a meditation. But just so much information there, packed full of, I mean, just, and the overall impact at the end is that you have this incredibly strong understanding and appreciation of the complexity of the natural world, and that this idea, you know, that you do kind of deconstruct this a notion that I think a lot of people have, that nature is away from us if we're in the, you know, if we're in the unnatural world, whatever that is, you know, the civilized world, nature is far away, and we can't really understand, it's too exotic for us, you know, to experience on a daily basis. And what you really bring forth is this, the idea that you can experience incredible complexity of nature anywhere.
Yeah, that's I'm glad you picked up on that. So at one level, the book is a celebration of the stories of creatures of the forest. So, you know, telling the stories that we know from studies of natural history and from science about all these different animals and plants and fungi and microbes. And at the surface, that's really what the book is about. But there's also another level, which it is, there are some philosophical arguments being made, but they're not being made directly. And so the book essentially extends an invitation to readers and says, come and look at the world through my eyes for a little while. And when you do that, you sort of get into the way, I hope, the way that I think about the world, in that this notion of separation, that humans are above and qualitatively different from the rest of the community of life. I don't think that's a position that can be supported scientifically anymore. That's the great Darwinian insight, or one of Darwin's many insights.
It's also the
Wait.
Western religious view of humans is we are above nature, and nature is built to serve us, you know, provided to us by God as a tool for us to use in order to live. And on some structural level, there is a validity to that. You know, that's what actually people have done. They've lived, used nature to construct human life. But
Well, and that's
by
all
definition,
species do, right?
right, but by
The
definition that,
woodpecker is doing the same thing.
right, and but what you pointed, I thought that the perception that you brought forth, which you just described, is, well, by, of course, that means by definition we are in nature every minute of our lives.
Yeah, and the human mind is one of those great natural productions. We don't know what the mind of a snail is like. I speculate a little bit on that in the book, or the mind of some other creature with a nervous system. But we do have a sense of the texture of our own mind, and that also belongs in this world, I would argue, is not some sort of separate thing. It's deeply connected to our nervous systems. And so the question that then comes from that view is, who are we, and what does that do for our view of ethics or environmental ethics? If we actually belong here, we can no longer think of ourselves as floating above as some kind of angelic creatures dropped down on earth here among all these other shabby non-angelic creatures, nor can we think of humans as being this stain that's destroying the world and needs to be eliminated in order for nature to be beautiful and coherent. I think humanity's participation in the rest of the community of life is part of that community. That doesn't mean that whatever humans decide they want to do is fine, but I do think it means that any environmental ethic or worldview cannot have a big gulf anymore between us and them. And I would say actually some elements of the, I mean, of religions, and even some in the Western tradition, get towards that a little bit. So when people talk about kinship as cousins, for example, seeing the rest of the world as our cousins, and I think Francis of Assisi had some, you know, this notion of a brother wolf and sister moon. You know, that's he was not a Darwinist, but there's a way in which that view could be compatible with a Darwinian view. There are other things that Francis of Assisi probably believed that are not compatible with that, but So I think one of the challenges now is to say, given that we've inherited a lot of cultural baggage and stories and myths and so on, how do we think about those? How do we tell those stories? Which do we need to keep and which do we need to abandon in the light of this firmer understanding of our kinship?
One of the things that struck me, and this kind of follows what you're just saying, is there was a point in the year in which there was a disturbance in the. Oh, and I guess I should say, because we didn't really mention this, but this is a piece of old growth forest in Tennessee, but it's not a protected forest. Well, it is protected, but it's not a national park or anything like that.
Right. So it's the patch of land is actually owned by the university, and the university has a commitment not to cut it down or anything. But that's not, there's no legal protection beyond the board of governors of the university.
Right, and people can walk through it. You said you
Oh,
mentioned,
yeah.
you're near a golf course, and I think I love this kind of philosophical meditation that you went through, or this ethical conflict that you had about the golf ball arriving in your field of vision. Should you remove it? Is it natural? This kind of goes to what we were what you were just talking about. Of course, the golf ball is made out of plastic and is not natural in the sense that I mean, we automatically dismiss it as not natural when we see plastic in the woods. We know that human beings have been there in some way and think of it as somehow disturbing the natural world. But ultimately, that it's made from oil that came from inside the under the ground that we have dug up and converted for our own uses, and it will eventually. It may take a really long time, but rocks take a really long time to erode. Plastic may also take a really long time to decompose. We just don't know what effect it has to take this formerly unavailable oil product and make it available in that particular ecological environment. But your question was whether to remove it or not, or whether to leave it there because it is essentially not your role to determine what belongs there or not as you, the observer.
Yeah, now, yes, I would say that is true. I would also say that the fact that this 1 square meter is a place that I determined that for a year I wouldn't manipulate added another layer of complication to this. So I had it basically a meditation practice of watching this 1 square meter without messing with it. And that was pretty easy when, as long as it was bees and flowers and other things, and just don't disturb them, other than my presence being there obviously affected some of the animals. But then this man-made object, and not just any man-made object, but a plastic golf ball that was shot from the top of a cliff by a golfer who evidently didn't give a damn about putting his or her plastic trash into an old-growth forest. This thing lands in my little 1 square meter, so it presents this challenge to my own self-imposed rule of not messing with the 1 square meter. But it also becomes in the book as a symbol of humanity's industrial productions. And what are we to make of those things as we think of ourselves as actually belonging in this world? And I think there's a very fine line here. The argument is not that plastic is this great thing to be dumping in the world. And I think one of the great tragedies of our time is how much plastic is being thrown into the woods and into the oceans. The oceans are just full of plastic garbage that's killing all these other species out there. So that's an enormous problem. And yet, what was it that made those pieces of plastic? It was Homo sapiens. And what is Homo sapiens but a very clever little primate? And so you can see that plastic as being the outward manifestation of a particularly successful evolutionary branch on the tree of life. And that branch is becoming so successful that it's threatening its own existence. And so, what I don't do in the book is offer a firm conclusion, like all plastic is good, all plastic is bad. We should, remove it from all natural areas or seemingly natural areas and not others. But really sort of play with some of these tensions that exist there. And another tension is that the plastic is really just the most obvious of our pollutants. The forest also has mercury and lead and organic molecules, all of which weren't there before industrialization happened. And so there are all these microscopic little golf balls, if you like, present throughout the entire world. So there is nowhere in the world you can go to get away from this. And my reaction sometimes is just to then turn that into self-loathing, right? That humans have just become this aberration that we need to do something about, and really the world would be a more beautiful place if we could just get rid of them. And I don't think that self-loathing is helpful. I think it's unhelpful as a rhetorical strategy because it's not going to win many people to your cause. But deeper, it's not helpful because to love what we might call nature and to hate humanity doesn't add up because humanity is part of that nature. So these arguments fold into themselves in complicated ways and help us get beyond the simple answers like all humans are bad or just that we're going to look at nature for examples of how to live our lives ethically, and all those kind of knee-jerk reactions that have an emotional appeal, but I don't think stand up to any kind of rigorous intellectual examination, particularly not in a Darwinian light.
No, that's true. Although I think there is still, once you get past the idea that a kind of radical anti-human approach is not called for, you still mm-hmm. have to contend with how should humans behave.
Yep.
In the mm-hmm. in the natural world, not
right,
only
right.
not as a, not even if it's about ethics, but even if it's all, it could be about self-interest. You know, that
mm-hmm.
instead of thinking about one's daily life without responsibility or connection to other, I think maybe what you're able to come to here, and I think fair to say that the book helps you in this understanding because
mm-hmm.
it personalizes and makes the relationship of a human being to the natural world more close, is
mm-hmm.
the idea that not all behavior by humans is necessarily productive, constructive, valuable, or beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could argue that, you know, having, once you understand and have a sense of what complexity exists all around you, that it would help you make the decision, say, not to throw your plastic into the ocean, or
right.
You know, drive your four-wheel drive across a threatened habitat,
mm-hmm.
because there's a reason why it's valuable to have that habitat, not just because, you know, someone said, oh, we must protect that, you know, species. You know, there's a bigger reason. I think people have really, the opponents have also simplified the argument to in the other direction. You know, that what do we care about that one species? There are hundreds of millions of species, and if a few
mm-hmm.
disappear, so what?
Right. Yeah, you know, and I think the answer to that is that we cannot answer that question about how we should behave in the natural world unless we both know something about the natural world, actually know the names of some of these species and who lives in our local environment and so on, but also that unless we're actually in relationship with those things, with some kind of both emotional and intellectual connection to those other species. So whatever somebody's position is, whether it's, you know, sort of from the environmentalist camp or the camp that's more, you know, in favor of development and use of nature in sometimes extreme ways, I'm not particularly impressed by those arguments if they're not coming from a place of relationship and understanding about the system that is being discussed. So, for example, in the Southeast here, there's a lot of debate about how we should manage forests. And so, and I've been involved in some of those discussions, and we'll go to meetings in big cities somewhere, you know, in a conference center completely surrounded by non-native species, and the statements that are made in some of those meetings by people on both sides about forest that they've never walked in, that they've never sat and listened to the birds, and probably couldn't name which bird species would be present, or, you know, birds are one of my favorites, but pick some other group of organisms. To me, those discussions are entirely mind games, or at least largely mind games, rather than being whole body, being informed by all our senses, and actual knowledge of place. And the minute we abstract ourselves from the reality of nature, we're almost bound to make mistakes. It'd be like trying to put on a play. We're going to put on Midsummer Night's Dream, but we don't know who any of the players are in this. We've never heard of Puck or Oberon, and we don't actually know all the nuances of the plot. And my fear is that as we lose connection to natural history and to the particularities of the natural world, which varies considerably regionally, we lose the ability to interact with the rest of the community that we're engaged with in ways that are going to be helpful.
No, I think that's absolutely right, that the alienation from nature and also the alienation from food, the inability that most people have to even understand where their food comes from. It's how can you talk about farm policy and food, you know, food policy and food systems if you've never actually even been on a farm or been to the industrial kinds of farms that we have today? You know, people are just, they don't want to know, or maybe they don't have time. You know, I know we have generations of kids who think food comes from the supermarket, and that's about all they know.
I would say that that goes both ways. So a lot of the debate about, say, industrial food, one of the things that I have learned through my teaching of agriculture is that it actually pays to talk, to have the students talk to some people who are doing so-called industrial farming, to listen to their perspective on why they're growing genetically modified crops, which most of the students in my classes are pre-adapted or pre-oriented to not think very highly of. And yet to actually sit down and listen to a farmer saying, you know, I've been farming this land for multiple decades, and when I flipped to this GM crop that allowed me to till my soil less, all the streams suddenly ran clear because there was less erosion. That doesn't mean that GM crops are necessarily good. It won't convince anyone of that, I don't think, or at least some of them won't be convinced. But it does add some nuance into our knee-jerk opinion that, well, you know, all genetically modified crops are bad, and all organic farming is good. And that's what I fear a lot of the sort of national level discourse is devolving.
Yeah, well, it's mostly uninformed debate.
right.
It is true on both sides. Although I do think, to go back to what you were saying about being part of the natural world, the other thing is that, and I think you talk about this in the book, that by necessity, slowing down one's operations within the world makes it possible to see more. You know, I am very fond of the great geographer Carl Sauer, and that was one of the things he talked about. And, you know, practicing and understanding geography is you actually have to walk the land. You can't drive through it. You can't fly over it. You can't see anything unless. And what your book does in this absolutely extreme way is bring that home. That this idea of, I still love the concept of studying closely and deeply and for a long period of time. I mean, you've gone sort of in both directions if we looked at it as a graph, you've gone down and across in this book. You're looking at a small piece of land in an environment for a long period of time, which both of those things are unusual, if not unique. You know, I know a lot of people who do field work in biology will stake out a territory and, you know, look at it for a period of time. But
I think there are these days, I think there's quite a hunger for that. And one of the gratifying things that I found having this book published is a number of people who've contacted me to tell me, you know, I have a practice that's really similar to that. You know, maybe they're not writing a book about it, which you know, is fine. It may be blogging or taking photos or just keeping having the practice be a very, very private thing, is that as our culture and economy pushes us to just move faster and faster and just be more and more fragmented in our attention, when people get a taste of what it's like to actually have a long-term interaction with one patch of land that isn't driven by any particular agenda, like, well, I've got to, see some amazing species here, or I'm going to find some kind of spiritual enlightenment. If it's just taking it as it is, I'm just going to observe this, whether or not I find it particularly exciting at the moment, and return over and over again, that tiny little patch of land opens up. It's almost like using a pinhole camera. The world becomes, the focus of the world becomes crisper, and you see more in it, paradoxically, by looking at less of the world. And that sounds ridiculous, but that's the foundation of contemplative practice, I would argue.
Oh no, it doesn't sound ridiculous to me at all. No, I thought now clearly you have studied Buddhism at some point. Do you meditate? Do you practice Buddhism?
I do. Well, I wouldn't say I do not view myself as embedded in any particular religious tradition, although I have a lot of respect for a number of religious traditions. Buddhism and Christianity in particular are the ones that I know best. I do have a meditation practice. It's although using the word meditation sounds a little grandiose, I sit down and shut up for 20 minutes twice a day and rest my attention on my breath. And the agenda there is just to do it. And so I sit down and I do it, and then I'm not hoping for anything out of that practice beyond just, in some ways, it's a big kind of a life experiment. What happens if you do this repeatedly? Does it change the texture of your life or not? And I think, at least in some parts of Buddhism and also in some parts of the monastic traditions of Christianity, that is a huge part of both of those traditions. And I suspect in other religious traditions as well, although I don't know those.
Yeah, no, well. I think the notion of contemplation, of slowing down and disconnecting from the sensory stimulation of your normal day-to-day, I think is important. I read something recently where a librarian actually was calling on people to be more contemplative just in their daily lives in some small way. Might be in just not sitting in front of the computer trying to do things all day, not talking. It's just the value of contemplation, the value of stopping doing whatever you're doing. And as you said, people can find that in whatever way they do. But I did feel sort of like this book had this kind of zazen quality of being right. Using the ability to see differently as a lens to be able to think differently as well.
Absolutely, and the other part I think that is important is coming, or the at least for me was an important motivation, was a desire to go out into the forest without having a preconceived notion of what was going to happen or an agenda of things I wanted to see or even later to write about. So as a teacher and as a scientist, I go into the world a lot with an agenda. So we're going to the woods and we're going to talk about the nitrogen cycle, or I'm going to give a lecture on natural selection, or I've got a hypothesis about the evolution of this particular group of animals. And there's nothing wrong whatsoever with those. It's a good thing for scientists to have hypotheses and teachers to have lesson plans. But I really personally wanted to go out in a different kind of way and just be open to the possibility of nothing happening or of unexpected things happening, of letting go of control. And that is a really important part of a meditation practice, is that the first thing that happens in any sitting meditation is that your mind feels relaxed for about 2 seconds, and then a thought arises.
Right.
Usually a disturbing thought. And the only practice of meditation is that's okay, and that's perfectly normal. In fact, that's what meditation is. You notice that thought when you do. It may be 10 minutes later because you've gotten onto that thought and gone down the river on it. You just return your attention gently back to the breath. And what I was doing was an ecological equivalent to that was when my attention was wandering to other places in my mind, going to the past or the future. I just brought it back and paid attention to this one square meter that in some ways was a lot easier to keep my attention on because there was always stuff happening there.
Right, and things change.
Input.
Right, every day you would be able to see something different, either because of the seasonality or, you know, you might. I think one of the things you talked about was the caterpillars eating. You know, you would see holes in the leaves. It would spur. I thought that was interesting that you know you were able to spur thought based on you know a single observation. You can actually go in a almost like a research direction just from one single observation. Not necessarily of anything big. I mean, there were, you know, in the book, most of the observation is of very, what we might call mundane things that are visible to us all the time, like, you know, the lichens or fungus or caterpillars or ticks or even the chickadees. I loved that the discussion you went into of the basically bird biology. From hearing the calls of certain birds at one particular day, I just that was to me really one of the great moments in the book. But also, I thought that the discussion of the tick life cycle also was, you know, just all of this from a very small. And then the other one was the great one about the ant going after the caterpillar. I mean, there were terrific. And I'm sure each reader will have her or his own response, you know, the thing that really makes them feel, you know, kind of special about what they're reading. But there were many of those for me, and I thought most of them turned out to be about really unusual small observations that led to these wonderful. You wouldn't call them digressions, but in a certain way they are. You know that. From looking at what's going on, you're spurred then to find out more about what's going on.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think there are two components there. One is seeing the drama and the aesthetic, you know, the different layers of aesthetic interest in everyday actions, like just seeing a tick on a shrub. Well, let's take a real close look at this tick and see how it's behaving. And what I tried to do was hold that up and really just try to describe that so people could, perhaps for the first time for some people, actually notice what is a tick really like or what are these bees doing in these wildflowers. And then kind of riffing on that. So, you know, we're going to talk about ticks. Let's see where that takes us. And, you know, often it takes us into evolutionary history and the interaction of the forest with people, ticks in particular there, because Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases are becoming such a huge problem for many people. There's all kinds of ways that particular observation unfolds. So it's the particularities of the moment that then opens a window into all kinds of crazy stuff. And often when I'm writing these chapters, I don't even know where we're going. You know, I've got a plan, and then halfway through the chapter, it's clear that plan is not going to work out. And so we go on in a different route that usually winds up, you know, I get the sense this is going to be a good chapter if I'm really excited. Wow, I'd never thought about how that connected to that. And that's informed by this particular story that I read, you know, in a book from the 1900s or something. So, yeah.
So are you still going into the woods, into this particular spot, or have you moved to doing something different now?
Yeah, I still go into the woods a lot. I have not, I revisit that one spot fairly regularly, but I don't have the same practice there. You know, for this one year, I really went a lot. And in fact, now I can't go there as much because I'm working. I took a leave to do this set of observations, and so to spend a lot of time out there. So I am continuing to do those nature observations. I've been tweeting, which, you know, it seems for a lot of people the idea of naturalists tweeting seems a little strange, but I think tweets are just fabulous ways of sharing just little natural history observations. And I think that's what we need more of in the tweetmosphere is little observations of the rest of the world. So this world is amazing, and it's not just all about humans. So let's get some stuff out there about, you know, the squirrels and the lichens and the fungi.
Ah,
and I've been,
so
yeah.
What is your Twitter identity,
my
so people will
is
be able to follow you?
It's at DG Haskell.
All right, good.
DG Haskell. And my I've also got a blog, which is I've had a lot of fun doing really short essays about things that are happening in the, just in the woods and on my travels and so forth. But I do I'm starting to work on some other longer writing projects that grow out of the observations in the forest from that year, but will not be based on the same kind of practices, you know, the same square meter.
So, and is your background, you teach biology at University of the South in Suwannee,
yes.
Tennessee. Have you been mostly a biologist through your academic career?
Yes, absolutely. So here I teach a variety of biology, mostly field biology, and I've been here for 17 years now. And I got to say that it's a fabulous place to wind up because there's a great university and we've got all these woods all around us. So I can be in the woods on 5 minutes on my bike. And that's really, that's a privilege to be in that.
No, it is pretty great. Well, I think I've been in the woods in Tennessee in my own, you know, I did some field biology work many, many years ago. And I loved the Tennessee woods. I thought they were just is spectacular.
They're Tennessee is. I had not, until I took the job here, I hadn't really spent much time in Tennessee. And the thing I love here is that it's, you know, on the East Coast, there's this real biological continuity. So the forests here have many of the same species that are in New York and that are down in Florida. And Tennessee is sort of midway, so we get kind of the best of both worlds. So we get the beautiful falls that folks have in New England, and then we also get some, you know, the springtime begins early, and we get some of these nice southern treats without having to deal with you know, it being 110 degrees all
right.
summer.
Right, you don't get the extreme winter, you don't get the extreme summer.
Right. Yeah.
And plus, you do have in the eastern Eastern Tennessee, you have the mountains, so you can go up and essentially replicate the environment of the north.
Exactly. Yeah, if you drive up the Smoky Mountains, you go from Southern Cove Forest. By the time you get to the top, you're in the equivalent of a Canadian forest.
Right. It's fantastic. Yeah.
So we have that a little bit here. We're on a plateau that's 1,800 feet. It drops off 1,000 feet, so there's a little bit of elevation change here, but not as dramatic as the Smokies. Yeah, my background was in, before I was here, I was in the Ecology and Evolution program at Cornell University, working in the Ecology and Evolution department there, and also at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, where I studied bird sounds and the effects of predation on bird sounds. So that was just a fabulous place to be a graduate student. So many amazing biologists all crowded into one town.
Well, and that explains some of your, in this book, some of your description of bird calls. That makes sense that you're sensitized and aware of them. And that was good.
I do a fair amount. And actually, while I've been here at Suwannee, I've come to emphasize that more and more and have students really learn lots of bird songs and quantify soundscapes around both in buildings and around buildings, as well as out in the forest and in areas that are not quite so human dominated. And it's a really interesting way of getting into the environment, because sound, unlike light, goes around things and penetrates things. So even if you turn your back on a sound, you're hearing it. And so it's a really interesting way of slipping into the nature of a place, and by nature I mean in the biggest sense, both humans and other things that are normally thought of natural, is by paying attention to the soundscape. And so Cornell set the seeds for all of that, gave me many of the quantitative tools, and I had a wonderful PhD committee and an advisor that set me on that route towards just being in love with the biology of this continent and how that biology connects to big stories in ecology and evolution. And before that, I was an undergrad at Oxford in the zoology program, which is also just a fabulous place to study.
Well, you've been in good places. Well, I really want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me about your book. I think it is a
Well, thank you.
wonderful, wonderful book, The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature, David George Haskell. I highly recommend it, published by Viking. It's a hardcover, and I think it's a terrific book. So,
Well, thank you, David. It's been a great pleasure
thanks,
having this
David.
Conversation.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, and thank you very much. Thank you.